We don't get sleep, we don't get kick with them two hands.
That's radio, passionate, genuine, personal.
CKE. I had a little donkey, take it to a lady, stick a piece of chocolate, stick it in his nose hole. Oh Lord, me don't.
Tune in to CKUW 95.9 FM for Dialogue, Gravel Roads to City Lights, every second Friday at 8 a.m. I'm co-host Kaylin Spain, and we facilitate conversations bridging rural and urban Manitoba on hot topics.
And I'm Mary Ann Sorelli. In May, we'll be hosting interesting guests on topics as part of the MayWorks Festival of Labor and the Arts. May 8th, we'll be hosting Susan Prentice from Winnipeg, and Katie McInnes from Clearwater, Manitoba, to explore what it's like being a working mom in rural and urban Manitoba.
On May 22nd, we will host Bea Brusk, the president of Canadian Labour Congress, and Fred Tate, longtime National Farmers Union activist. This show is called Following the Money on Food Cost Inflation. I'm sure you may be concerned about food prices these days, so join us on May 22nd. See you then.
Welcome, CKUW listeners, to Gravel Roads and City Lights, Dialogues, Gravel Roads to City Lights. It's Friday, May the 8th, and I'm your host, Mary Ann Sorelli, on air with my co-host, Kaylin Spain. Hi, Kaylin.
Hi there. Good morning. It's almost Mother's Day, Mary Ann. I think it's in 2 days. This is crazy. So this is our Mother's Day. Well, we're calling it May Day to Mother's Day show, right? That's the title?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we're here with two guests who we'll introduce in just a minute. We are excited to talk about working mothers. What does it mean to be a working mother in this day and age in urban and rural Manitoba? So this is something near and dear to my heart, Mary Ann. I am a working mother. I started a job last year working remotely, and I also live on a farm with my in-laws. And so, you know, the cross sections of how my job and how my in-laws understand working from home, what that means, what time I go pick up the kids, you know, this is something I feel very passionately about. So I'm really excited to kind of dig into this, this dialogue with our two guests. So, first off, from rural Manitoba, from Clearwater, the Clearwater area some people might be familiar with because of the Harvest Moon Festival. Maybe you're living in Winnipeg and you venture out there for the Harvest Moon Festival in the fall. We have Katie McInnes. So welcome here, Katie.
Thank you.
So you're first generation farmer. You're also a Wolseley kid, just like me, hey?
That's right. Yeah, born and raised and then exported out to southwestern Manitoba.
Yes. And now you're running the Dogs Run Farm.
Yep. My husband, Colin, and I run a pastured livestock farm here. And we're both first generation farmers, so have built this from some pretty meager beginnings. But it's currently our full-time employment for both of us. And we had quite a bit of off-farm employment along the way as well.
Amazing. So if you can give our listeners an idea, like what point did you start working full time on the farm?
So I became a mother in 2021 through the pandemic. My son is 5 years old now. And at that point, we began to sort of switch and really gear up our farm to try and make a full time living for us. It wasn't until this past year that Colin quit his like 1 day a week job. I do still do a little bit of work for the Harvest Moon Society, but that's kind of extraneous to, I still work full time on the farm. We both do. So it's really been in the last 5 years or so that we've focused on making this our full time living.
Okay, thanks. That's good for context, because I know you personally, and I followed your farming journey, but it's good for our listeners to know a little bit about that. We also have Dr. Susan Prentice here, who is a sociology professor at the University of Manitoba and a longtime member of the Manitoba Child Care Coalition. So welcome here, Susan.
Hi.
Good to have you here. Hi, anything to add to your bio that or you want our listeners to know about you?
Oh, maybe the fact that my kids are now 28 and 30, and I feel badly that we still haven't solved the childcare crisis for younger mothers these days.
Okay, well, we're going to get into that. I want to hear your thoughts. What would you say, like, I guess, where are you at in sort of a working mom timeline of sorts?
Well, my kids aren't at home anymore. They're 28 and 30. My partner and I had all the traditional wrestles that working parents have for a number of years. We had one kid at one place and one kid at another. You know, I researched childcare policy, but it took me years to get, you know, our kids into a licensed childcare space. And back in the day, it felt like we were paying through the nose, right? Our childcare costs many years were over $14,000 a year. Back then. So I feel very, very happy that for parents now who are using licensed childcare, for the cost across the province is just $10 a day. I just want to say that, you know, that's a real victory for social movement advocates. Like, we won that. That was a big full court press to bring the price of childcare down, and it's a good thing it happened. The problem is not enough parents are lucky enough to find those spaces. And even Monday to Friday, 9 to 5 childcare doesn't do everybody what they need. But we've made some progress on that front. And I try to remember that when I'm feeling discouraged.
Well, and something that's more recent is the removal of the additional fee for those that have subsidized childcare. So that's another victory for the childcare movement that's been in the works for a long time. Hey, Susan.
Sure is. You know, we had this thing where we would try to get blood from stones. You could be a low income parent, really low income, single parent, one kid, two kids. You know, you're well below the poverty line to get a maximum subsidy. And we would still ding you $2 a day for each child. You know, back when the commission did the report, they estimated that a single mother with two kids just paying the $2 a day would be paying not far off 10% of her family income in that surcharge. So the decision of our current government to finally drop that $2 a day is a very, very welcome policy move.
Yeah. Yep. Give them credit for that. So I'm also wanting to just mention, you know, the fact that this is a unique episode in May. And, you know, we're bookending it between May Day and Mother's Day. So it's kind of that bridge between, you know, being a working mom. And it's part of MayWorks, the Festival for Labor and the Arts, which is a whole month long of different activities and art shows and all sorts of different things. You can find out about that at the MayWorks.ca website. So, you know, having this be part of that working class understanding of the importance of childcare to parents that are working is a big theme of this show. And we want to really look at the situation, and I think starting off in rural Manitoba, because I, like all of you, I have one daughter who's now 28, and I was an MLA when I had my daughter, and I'd already been an MLA for about 8 years, and I ended up wanting to have, initially she was only in part-time childcare because I wanted to still be with her, and her dad stayed home with her for a while. And one of the things I always remember is how they would get upset if she came a little bit late. And I would say, well, I work really unusual hours, and I want to make sure that when I'm home in the day with her, if I've been out late at night, I can spend time with her. So it was that kind of flexibility at the childcare center that, you know, we were looking for. And I can maybe talk later on a little bit more about my experience of, you know, at that time I was living in Transcona and the challenge of keeping that childcare space. But it's these kind of, you know, realities in the system that we've had that parents have. And for how challenging it's been in an urban area, Katie, I know that what it's even more difficult in rural areas to find childcare. So I want to hear a little bit about your experience, Katie, of being a working mom on a farm in a rural area.
Sure. Yeah, there's, I wanted to start off by saying that before I became a mother, I worked in childcare as a childcare assistant, which is sort of the lowest rung on the ladder of trained childcare providers within Manitoba. I spent about 3 years working 1 or 2 days a week at one of our local childcare facilities. So that actually really gave me a good understanding about the other side of being a parent when I did become a parent. I actually took that job because I thought it would make me a better parent when I was going to become a parent, and I think it did. Childcare is, I've been farming for 13 years. Childcare is the hardest job I've ever had, hands down. It takes an incredible amount of skill and resolve and self-regulation and understanding and compassion that I think our childcare workers are sorely underpaid and underappreciated. When I was working that job at the time, and childcare assisting is that entry-level position, I was making minimum wage and working my absolute butt off and coming home exhausted. And I wasn't a parent. I could go home and wasn't going home to continue to parent. Most of my other colleagues were parents, you know, they were still working that type of job for the rest of their evening and the next morning and beyond. So I think it really has, as a parent who uses childcare now, really helped me to better understand what those workers are going through. Those pay rates have gone up since I was in my position. There's been a bit more stabilization of those childcare rates, which I've been really happy to see. This also happens to be early childhood educators appreciation week. My son and I, we wrote a really nice card for all of our daycare staff that we appreciate so much and really tried to get that across how much they're an important part of our family. Now, I'm so grateful that I do have childcare. I have a full-time childcare spot for my son who will be going into kindergarten this fall. And I do, because kindergarten in the school that we're going to be doing out here rurally, it's full days every other day. So I'm going to need childcare on the opposing days. And it looks as though the childcare facility that he's in now is going to keep a space for me to have on those alternate days. I might have to be sharing, you know, with another person. But they're kind of making that work for us, and I'm really grateful for that. But some folks have the half day every day childcare, which can make it really difficult for parents who are working either on farms or regular 9-to-5 jobs to go and do those pickups and drop offs. I see a lot of grandparents who are very need to be involved in those sorts of childcare transitions as well. And I'm already facing what will be almost for sure the loss of any childcare July 1st of 2027 as my son ages out of the preschool age and becomes considered school aged. Those spaces are secondary in the childcare institutions out here. So there's not, you know, our childcare centers are full of preschool age children. There's not a lot of room for the school age kids. So July 1st, my farm is a very busy place, and I might have a six-year-old here home with me full time. And I'm not exactly sure how that's going to go. I've already tried to get my name on, you know, lists in advance to see in case there are spaces. Both childcare facilities that are on sort of either side of the town that I'm located in are trying to expand their centers. One is heavily fundraising. You know, they just had a social. I mean, it's the community members who are, you know, buying beers to try and make a bigger daycare. And the other daycare is struggling with some of the regulation associated with expanding. And yeah, it's a struggle to increase these spaces, even though the demand is there. The childcare centers are full, there's waiting lists, and we just, you know, I'm grateful for the space that I have, but I would love to see nobody struggling to be able to do the work that they love and the work that they need to provide for their family because of childcare stopping that possibility.
Yeah. Katie's really nailed it. You know, sometimes I think that if you're just looking at the childcare issue from a distance, you think, oh, the biggest problem's got to be with the really little kids. And surely by the time they go to school, things are all kind of worked out. The data tell us in Manitoba, we've got a childcare space for about 1 in 5 children who might need a space. And the best age group, the luckiest age group, are the preschoolers, because we've got a space for about 1 in every 3 of those. But when it comes to school age kids, like Katie's will soon be, we've got a space for only 12%. So we do a bad job about thinking about kids. you know, everyone who's got a kid knows that you can't leave them alone legally till they're 12. And even at 12, sometimes you don't want to leave them alone. 12 is when children can babysit. But the big national rollout that brought us $10 a day childcare was really targeted at younger children. So it was children up to the age of school. So older children are a real issue. 6 to 12 is a real age group that needs thinking about. And that's got to be the next push, I think, across the country for thinking about access. But Katie, your friends and neighbors selling beers and trying to raise money for their daycare, that's normal all across Manitoba. We rely on volunteers to start up daycare centers. We rely on volunteers to provide 40% of the capital cost to start one up. So where neighbors and friends can't get together and do that, they're almost guaranteed will not be a childcare center running. We wait for volunteers to do this work. It's not how we organize the school system, but it's how we organize childcare.
Yeah, it's that interesting treating of our youngest population as completely without the same kinds of needs. It's so insane. It's wild to me how it's just considered so separate, and that the care of these children is not considered highly skilled work in the same way as school teachers are. From my point of view, that was some of the most demanding work that I did, was providing care to small children. And a lot of what the staffing is based on is these really important ratios. So you can have one staff person to four infants. So that's under the age of two. Whereas for children from two to 5 years old, so those other, the preschoolers who are not infants, you can have one childcare provider to eight children. Now, that can mean one childcare provider to 8 2-year-olds. I can remember being in that position, you know, and trying to get 8 2-year-olds out the door with their snowsuits on is a really big challenge for anybody, and especially getting paid minimum wage to do that. I remember shaking my head thinking, this is not worth it.
Yeah. Well, from a worker's point of view, you know, we've got data that tell us that there's no post-secondary education you can do that will give you a smaller return on your education dollar than working in childcare. Now, that's just the money side, right? As you said, Katie, the work is enormously satisfying, affirming, gratifying, life-enhancing work, but it's exhausting and demanding. We've got this whole history as a society of just thinking that, you know, nice ladies like children and they can just do it themselves and you don't really need to pay them very well. And it's this long history of really scandalously underpaying childcare workers.
And it probably goes hand in hand with our misappreciation of motherhood and of care work and women's work. And, you know, no surprises there that most caregivers in childcare facilities, in old age homes, in all kinds of caregiving situations in healthcare are women. Yeah. And their work is underappreciated.
Somewhere between 96 and 98% of the early childhood education staff in Canada are women. There's all these men who are missing out on this important work, but it's not unique, actually. Even in places like Sweden, more than 9 in 10 people taking care of children are women. It seems like a pretty widespread, deeply organized gender gap.
Yep.
There's so much to follow up on here. This is great. You're just sharing so much good information, you know, the history in terms of this expectation that women wouldn't work and how that plays into the lack of childcare and the system. You really said something that hit home for me. And, you know, this, it would be referred to as a lack of policy coordination between the number of spots available for the kids that need childcare, the work requirements for parents in terms of any worker has to work, you know, at least 8-hour shifts, probably. And the requirement, though, that kids can't be alone till they're 12. So we've set up this huge gap for finding childcare Olympic feat that has to go on. And I wanted to give you a chance, Susan, to just comment a little bit more on Katie's description in rural areas, and maybe then talk a little bit about the urban situation as well.
Well, Katie, hard as it is for you, you're actually one of the lucky mums, because across Manitoba, 76% of children live in what we call the childcare desert. Childcare desert would be a postal code where there's at least three children competing for every one childcare space. So That means most of 75% of Manitoba is a childcare desert. And the reason it's a desert is because we've waited for volunteers to start up and fund and operate their childcare centers. And most working parents don't have the time and energy to do that. So I'm happy for you that you've got care at least till next summer. And I hope you can find a stool age space. And if you spend more than a year on a waiting list, that's pretty typical. We've got survey data that says on average, parents will wait 16 months before they get a child care space. It's a little bit less bad in Winnipeg in particular. Brandon's having a very hard time with child care spaces. When the WISE waiting list got to 800 names, they stopped taking new names on the waiting list in Brandon. So it's less it's less terrible in cities, but it's still really hard. We still have child care deserts in cities because even in Winnipeg, we don't have nearly enough childcare space. There's no part of Winnipeg that has more than enough space for even a quarter of the children who might need it. There's a huge mismatch between supply and demand.
Yeah.
Absolutely wild. I mean, I see that too in our near town. I live near Arburg, north of Winnipeg, and see that as well. That's like a lot of moms who have tried to have their kid on the waiting list and kind of waiting for years, really, for a spot. And then really just like figuring it out between them and other moms or just staying home. And as Katie, you said, it's the care work, right? That is just the unpaid care work that there's someone that I follow online on Instagram around like looking at the cost of that, like of what that is actually worth. And it's so interesting. We can talk about that a little bit more later, but I'm really curious to hear more around like, how are people coping with this? Like, what are people like, what, especially mothers? I mean, parents are both responsible, but this often really falls on the woman. And I can identify with that as a mom of two. And so like, how are people figuring this out or coping? You know, what are you seeing, Katie, in your community around like mothers and parents that can't find those spots?
Yeah, I think it's often there are grandparents getting involved, especially with those sort of pickups and drop-offs. Colin and I moved from Winnipeg and actually are really fortunate that my mom and my parents moved about half an hour away from where we are now. And I do have usually weekly a half day from my mom on the days where my son is home, half a day on Tuesdays. And Colin's mom bought a little house to be nearby us some of the time. And she will come and do some, you know, overnights and sleepovers and stuff like that so that we can occasionally get a break. Or it's often when we actually have other really important farm work that needs to be done. So we do call on grandparents. And that is very, very common out here in the rural landscape, I would say. I think a lot of folks choose to settle in small communities because they can be close to family members and rely on that kind of care. I think there's interesting differences that I've noticed too, and this is very anecdotal. I don't have any, you know, hard evidence to back it up. I became a mother at 34, which is, you know, not a young person. My mother was 36 when she had me, so she's not a young grandmother. And it's more typical, I would say, for people to have their kids earlier in their life in rural areas. And so those grandparents are perhaps more available, have a little bit more energy, perhaps a bit more time, if they're not still working themselves. And many of them are, you know, a lot of these kids end up in tractors for a part of the day. They end up, you know, getting brought along on all kinds of farm work. They spend time in trucks. My son knows very well how to enjoy, you know, playing with ratchet straps in the back of the truck while we're checking cattle. You know, that is part of the reality for sure. And I think that there's beautiful aspects to that as a lifestyle, but it can be very stressful as a parent to get our work done with a kid in tow, especially, you know, sometimes farm work can be dangerous. So finding safe ways to do it too is part of the requirement.
Yeah. Farmers organizations have talked about that, right? It's one of the few workplaces where you find children, and it you know, sadly there are one hears too often about some of the really terrible life changing and life ending accidents sometimes. But when parents don't have choices, you try to pick the least worst option. What really happens, I think, you know, it's great if you have grandparents, it's great if you've got friends and neighbors, it's great when people can pool it all together, but Those are all kind of unstable, right? And if you're new or you don't have connections or you don't have nearby family or your family's not available, we really need to have a net of resources around it, right? And we don't do enough. And I don't think that people fully appreciate how much economic vulnerability we just want women to accept as risk, right? Like if you've got a male partner and you guys work it out and you work part-time or stay home and you make it work, right? Maybe that's a great arrangement for you, but you're a death or an accident or a divorce away from economic vulnerability. And a mother who's stayed home for a while and goes back into the labor force, like there'll be a lifetime career hit to her lifetime earnings. And as I approach pension age, right, to pensions as well, there's data that's just come out of Quebec, which I hope helps to change the national conversation. There's some economists who've tracked what happens to those moms in Quebec. You know, Quebec was way ahead of us. 1997, they came out with $5 a day childcare. And they're now looking at the end of the life, you know, retirement age of those moms who had early childcare starting in 1997. And they're now finding that women who have had childcare, their lifetime's lifetime earnings can be 27% higher than women who haven't had childcare. And if you think about it, it makes sense, right? Like you maybe didn't lose a promotion, right? You didn't take so much time out of work, right? You developed some job skills. And some of these gains are the strongest for women doing kind of what we might think of as blue collar work, right? It's not just big gains for professionals. It's also for working women. And the degree to which, as a society, we're confident getting women to privately carry the economic risk, right, of just hoping it all works out, I find it shocking. I find it really shocking.
That's so interesting, Susan. Oh, my goodness. 27%. Well, I mean, I mean, if I can jump in here, just from a kind of a rural perspective, too, and Katie, you can jump in here after me, but like, from a really like business perspective, if I look at the conversations that we're having with my in-laws right now, as a working mom, and, you know, even for them to just respect the fact that I have a job, that's a, you know, it's a full-time job. It's working from home, but that doesn't mean that I can take advantage of whatever and go move the cows or whatever. No, I'm not, you know, I have meetings and I want to take that job very seriously. And I take my career very seriously. I'm actually, our youngest is 3 years. So I've been in this job for less than a year. So coming back to the workforce was like a decision that I made with my partner, and also thinking around how can he come back to the farm? How can he return to the farm? He's self-employed. So it, from a business standpoint and on the farm, when I talk to farmers in my work too, is like the working mom is like such an integral part of that business and such an integral part of like farm succession. So like for my in-laws to really respect and understand that like it won't work for us to farm with his parents if I'm not working, because we need cash flow. So yeah, it's just like the significance of working moms and the importance of that, especially like in rural areas where there are a lot of businesses, there's farmers, like, and as you're saying, Katie, sometimes it's just like people just don't have much of a choice, and that often really falls on women. So yeah, it kind of goes back to maybe the expectation that we have as mothers. And I'm just wondering, Katie, like, if you can comment on what I've said, but also like, do you think there is like more of an expectation of mothers in rural areas? Do you see that, or have you experienced it? I mean, you're both first generation, and Colin's really awesome. I mean, he's a very progressive dad. So, but you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are, I think, a lot of farms that are being, you know, partially bankrolled by the mom's, you know, career. Often it's say in nursing or teaching, which allows, and a teaching career allows that mom to be home in the summer months full time, which is sometimes, you know, essential for that farm to operate, for somebody to be there watching the kids full time. And, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about how, you know, women, and I say women, you know, it's, we're talking about gender stereotypes here, but I'll use women as the sort of catch-all for a lot of the care work that happens on farms. Women doing work within the farm family or the farm landscape that allows the farmers to work 14 hours a day, right? And the farm only works when that farmer is able to work. Can catch me here. Sorry, I know I'm, can you hear me? So
yeah, you're good.
Work that allows, if the care work that is happening at home allows that father to, or the farmer to never take any time off, right? And that's the only way that the farm works, is if somebody is operating it for extended periods of time. You know, there's no overhead pay. But it doesn't get talked about. It's sort of celebrated in this, like, you know, meals from the fields and the late nights and the going. But you know that those farmers are not home doing laundry and taking kids to dentist appointments. And, you know, they're able to have their career because they're a full-time care worker at home, but that person's not considered a farmer, even though they're contributing to the farm operation.
And, yeah, exactly.
I like having that conversation with other parents and other farmers. And I really encourage other farmers to see the care work position. And I joke about it as, you know, the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Internal Affairs. Make that person one of your C-suite, you know, employees on your farm, because it's a really important role to play on family farms with children.
Yeah, for sure. I just want to note, if you're tuning in on CKUW, this is Dialogues. We're here with Katie McInnes from Clearwater, Manitoba. She's a farmer on the Dogs Run Farm. We're also here with Dr. Susan Prentice, a sociology professor at the University of Manitoba. We're talking about working mothers, and we are right in the conversation around what is the expectation of mothers, you know, in rural and urban areas. So, Susan, what are you seeing? Like, what do you think? I'm going to jump in here.
Well, do you mind if we spend a bit of time thinking about if we're talking about mothers or parents? Because I go round and round on this one, and it's something maybe listeners are thinking about as they're listening in. So on the one hand, right, if you talk about childcare is necessary for working mothers, you might be making things worse, right? You might be saying children are a maternal responsibility, and you might be reinforcing gender stereotypes. But on the other hand, if we just pretend that we're talking about impacts on parents, we will miss the fact that, as I explained earlier, the economic risk is largely carried by women in partnerships, and that most of the work is done by women in the household. And that even though we have parental leave policies that are for moms and dads, we've got mountains of data that tell us women take tons more leave than men take. And when we provide the care, we're looking at women who are mainly providing the care. So I bounce a lot myself over this dilemma of whether you, in naming this as a gendered problem of mothers, if I'm making it worse or if I'm revealing something that people don't spend enough time thinking about. I'm wondering what the rest of you think about this question.
Yeah, I think a lot about the, you know, the reality that we deserve and the reality that we have. And we're not there yet in terms of the sort of equity and equality places that I know, you know, most of us want to get to. And so I think it's important to reveal the realities. It's important to also use inclusive language. But I think it does a disservice to pretend that this is an equal problem felt by, you know, strictly men and strictly women.
Mm. Yeah. It's a bigger conversation for sure.
Well, and to think about the implications, particularly like you were describing on farms, because the issue that we're going to be talking about in our next show for May Works is going to be also looking at food cost inflation and how farmers are really also squeezed because they're not seeing the benefit from this huge increase in price of food. So to also put on top of that, the fact of the way that they're cobbling together, there's this patchwork quilt in childcare, and then farm families are cobbling together this sort of way of keeping the farm going and keeping care of their kids. It really deserves attention.
Yeah, I throw that
so,
in.
But I want, oh, go ahead, Susan.
So one of the things to think about, and I think it's a good thing, and maybe not obvious enough to everybody, but where families are lucky enough to get a childcare space in Manitoba for $10 a day, they do not actually have to be two working parents or a working parent or even a parent who's studying. We've said that it's a right of children and families to have access to this care, and we don't make it dependent on what the parents are doing. I think that's a really smart step because families that are raising children are doing a contribution for all of us. They're helping make a better world. They're bringing a next generation in. And I like the idea that you can use childcare, maybe because you want to be a volunteer, maybe because you've got family you want to take care of, maybe because you want to take a watercolor class, right? Maybe you just want to have a little bit of time for yourself. I think that we also need to remember that there's a child's right to care in addition to a parent's or a mother's right to service. Right. And keeping it all going in your head is it's a lot to juggle, but all the balls are in play.
Yeah, well, I wanted to bring up this session that Katie and I did for the Direct Farm Conference. We both sit on the board for Direct Farm Manitoba, which is an organization that a cooperative, actually, of farmers and farmers markets. And we talked about last year at our conference about these sort of invisible hats and visible hats that, you know, that women wear, you know, that everyone wears on farms. And in particular, there's, you know, there's so many invisible hats that moms wear, you know, the emotional labor, the unpaid work. And there's a lot of conversation online about this. It is like becoming a very, you know, maybe we can get a guest for a hot topic, Marianne, if we want to keep this conversation going. But, you know, it's kind of like recognizing that unpaid work, you know, the value of that, you know. So I think I'm wondering for both of you, like, but maybe we can start with you, Susan, is like, what is it, you know, what does it look like to really recognize that, I guess, like to recognize this invisible?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you were paid for it, you'd call it project manager and nobody would doubt it's high skilled work that could be well paid. But when you're doing the unpaid coordination work to keep a family going, it just looks invisible. We can throw other aspects in. I mean, Katie, have you been roped into being on the board of directors of the childcare center that you use yet?
I am on the board of directors of our.
Okay. So how much time do you spend as a volunteer keeping your childcare center going?
Well, luckily that's a really well-run board, and it's a part-time nursery school. So it's not been very demanding, although we did a project recently to upgrade our play structure, and I ended up taking on a lot of that outside of my realm of expertise, right, in terms of construction work. Yeah. But so far haven't been part of the board of directors of the daycare center, but some of my friends have. Yeah. And it takes a lot of volunteer labor just to keep the centers well thought, you know, well run.
Yeah. I mean, there's a real positive side to it, right? Parents get to control the services that they use, and there's a lot of direct democracy, but it's a huge amount of work. You know, you have to create staff manuals. You have to employ people. There's director liability. In the early stages, there's a huge amount of fundraising. I think all the time about that iceberg. You know, that iceberg floats because 9/10 of the iceberg is below the waterline, not fully visible, right? So you're a working parent and you have to run a childcare center. And I used to sometimes wish that we ran childcare like we ran schools, right? The school will be there whether a parent volunteers to run it or not. And a parent like Marianne who wants to come in one day a week and be there for lunch or volunteer in the classroom can do that. But the whole thing won't collapse without volunteers. And we've really relied on the volunteers across Manitoba to make it work. This has a very positive side in Manitoba that I don't want to ever lose, which is that Manitoba's childcare system is almost entirely not for profit. We don't deal with big box daycare the way they do in other provinces. We don't have private equity and financialization the way certainly, you know, Alberta, right? More than 65% of the spaces in Alberta are run for profit, which brings in a whole other set of dynamics. But it's a lot of work to ask volunteers to own and operate and run and fundraise and make the childcare system work. And yet if volunteers don't do it, you know, mums and parents don't have the services that they need. So there's a huge amount of work that goes unaccounted for. The formal economy only sees a thin slice of it.
Yeah, for sure. Katie, how about you? Like, what else are you seeing in terms of like the sort of these invisible hats? I think it was you actually that designed that session that we did at the conference. And you were the one that came up with this like concept of like this invisible, these hats that we sort of, and almost default, right?
Yeah, the default roles on a farm. And, you know, farms are unique in the same way that that perhaps another family run business might be, but farms operate 365 days a year. They operate in all kinds of weather and all kinds of conditions. And they require a lot of emotional labor, just as running a family does, right? I mean, no, farmers aren't really generally not able to take their hat off at the end of the day. And so, for instance, in my relationship with my husband, we discuss it as like he's the default farmer. He's going to make, you know, if things are going wrong, it's probably going to be him out there at 10 o'clock at night dealing with a calf that is calving that's going wrong or something like that. Whereas mm-hmm. I'm going to be inside dealing with the late bedtime that came along with this problem, plus making sure a load of laundry gets in. And, you know, so there's sort of default roles that we fall into, even though we might be capable of doing those different things. I might be able to deal with a calving situation, and Colin is, you know, more than capable of bedtime and laundry. But those hats just sort of get defaulted. And for me, in my career in agriculture, that has meant that I have received less training. I've received less opportunities to, you know, flex my muscles and develop my skills because I'm the default parent. And in the early years of our relationship, it meant that, you know, my son was way more attached to me than to Colin. It's different now, but, you know, it was harder. It was easier if I just did that parenting because the kid wanted me for bedtime and those things. So it makes the roots run even deeper in terms of these default hats that we wear, and it can cause, you know, all kinds of resentment and missed opportunities but it takes, of course, time and effort to cross train everybody on all the skills that it takes to run a household or all the skills that it takes to run a farm. So that session that we put on was really about starting those conversations and acknowledging that people within these roles on a farm end up wearing these default hats, and what can we do, or what problems does that cause, and what can we do about them?
Yeah.
This has been such a rich discussion of the challenges for working moms, working families, for kids that are being juggled around in this patchwork quilt that we've been talking about of working and having childcare, finding to fill the gaps. So I want to turn the attention now really towards what's the vision? What is needed to be done? You know, Susan, you talked about just the number of kids that is probably about half that in some age groups where there's the space for the kids that actually need it. And there's all sorts of issues. So I just want to give each of you a little bit of a chance to talk about the vision of what is required to have the kind of system that is going to support kids and families the way that they need to be supported.
Can I jump in, just because I know Susan's going to have a really great answer, and I'll just put my one thought in before she really rounds it out. I think that something that needs to shift, and Susan kind of touched on this earlier, was how we view children as part of our society and part of our community. I think that, you know, children have really been relegated to sort of a different class of citizen, and they're not really considered in part of, you know, policymaking, in part of community building. They're kind of this, you know, extra responsibility that should really just be the parents' problem. You had kids, it's your fault, deal with it. Whereas truly, children are part of all of our future, our collective community, and if you want to be even just really cynical about it, they're the future little taxpayers, right? So investing in them is good for everybody. into the future. And I just really would love to see a shift that doesn't see children sort of as this second class citizens that are really only the responsibility of parents, but that they are, you know, one of our most precious, it's so cheesy, but our precious resource that is everyone's responsibility, whether you're a parent or not.
Right. Yeah. And if when you're become a citizen is when you're productive and paying taxes, it kind of fits with that view. What about you, Susan? How would you respond?
Well, it's you know, it's going to take a wholesale new approach to thinking about families. I come at this from the perspective of family policy, right? We've done a very bad job in Canada for most of our history about thinking about family policy as a part of economic policy. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea is families are private. They take care of themselves. They do it for themselves, whether you're a young person needing childcare or an elder person needing older care, right? Families just take care of themselves. And that rested on a worldview and a practice that might have worked for some people a long time ago, but it no longer works for modern families. And it required real costs to women that weren't properly recognized. So, you know, when I'm the queen of the world, they'll be, pardon me. Gosh, that image was so exciting. They'll be really good parental leave for everybody who you can take a well-paid leave for long enough. There'll be good childcare when and where we need it. And frankly, one day it's going to be free, the same way that we walk into a public school and know it's paid by taxes. And we will reorganize some of the world of work so that, for example, when you do have care responsibilities, maybe you don't get the evening shift, right? When you do have care responsibilities, maybe you don't have kindergarten every other day, unless that really works for you. Because for some people, kindergarten every other day would be like hell. So I think what we're going to end up doing, if we listen carefully enough to the people who are affected by this, is really taking families very seriously as a part of that economic engine we all have to take much more care with.
Long live the queen.
That's great. Kaylin's going to wrap us up here, and I just want to make sure that we plug our next show, because it's going to be such a good follow-up talking about the cost of food inflation. And, you know, I think part of what you're describing, Susan, also requires wages to keep up with the cost of living if we're developing this future that is going to work for us.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Kaylin.
Yeah, excited about our next show, May 22nd, on about food inflation. We have two incredible guests on there as well. So one of the last questions that we normally ask our guests that we really want to hear from each of you is kind of, what do you want, you know, folks where in rural or urban Manitoba to know about what it means to really be, you know, who you are, and your voice is important on this show. So Katie, I want to start with you, I guess, is like, what do you want people in, let's say, urban Manitoba, when Winnipeg centers, you know, to know about what it's like to be a working farm mom? And you've already given us such an awesome insight into this today, but just last words about that.
I think, well, what I and a big part of the work that I do is about promoting the style of agriculture that we do, which is regenerative agriculture. And I guess what I really love people to know is that there is this resurgence of people who are trying to continue into the future to improve agriculture and make it better for the planet. And that includes a lot of women. There's a lot of women who are getting into this as their future. And we're doing our best to make space for new farmers in a really challenging climate. And a lot of those people are women. And so we're going to need a really good understanding of what families need and what rural people undergo to keep food being created in our province, mm-hmm. as well as creating new farmers.
Yeah. Appreciate those words. Well said, Katie. Yeah. How about you, Susan?
Well, Katie's so right. So I guess the next time you're talking to someone who says, oh, you know, we took care of our kids, if you have your own kids, you should take care of them. Or someone tries to tell you that childcare is only not a rural issue, only an urban issue. I just hope that everyone understands that we all depend on people and they depend on childcare. So it's really everybody's issue to figure out how to get this right.
Yes. It is all of our issue, and it's so important what we talked about today about just the significance of care work, the work that in many cases women are doing and in many cases working moms are doing. So I want to say thank you so much to both of you for your time today. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules. It's spring on the farm for you, Katie. So I think you got lots going on tomorrow. So thank you so much again to both of you for being with us. And you're always welcome back on the show. We, you know, are thinking kind of about maybe like next year, we could do like part two of some of the topics that we've explored. And so maybe we'll have you back on the show and to explore this again. And happy Mother's Day to everyone. If you're a mother or not, if you've lost a mother, if you don't have a mother, if you have a chosen mother, wish everyone, all of our listeners, a happy Mother's Day this weekend. And nice to see the sun coming out, finally warmed up in Manitoba. So take care, everyone, and we'll see you May 27th.
Tune in to CKUW 95.9 FM for Dialogue, Gravel Roads to City Lights, every second Friday at 8 a.m. I'm co-host Kaylin Spain, and we facilitate conversations bridging rural and urban Manitoba on hot topics.
And I'm Mary Ann Sorelli. In May, we'll be hosting interesting guests on topics as part of the MayWorks Festival of Labor and the Arts. May 8th, we'll be hosting Susan Prentice from Winnipeg, and Katie McInnes from Clearwater, Manitoba, to explore what it's like being a working mom in rural and urban Manitoba.
On May 22nd, we will host Bea Brooke, the president of Canadian Labor Congress, and Fred Tate, longtime National Farmers Union activist. This show is called Following the Money on Food Cost Inflation. I'm sure you may be concerned about food prices these days. So join us on May 22nd. See you then.
You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM
in Winnipeg.
Generous support to CKUW 95.9 FM is provided by Diversity Food Services. Diversity is a social enterprise committed to a just and fair food economy in Winnipeg. Spruce Catering is part of the Diversity Food Services family. A chef-driven, full-service catering company, the team brings together culinary talent for some of Canada's most prestigious food events. Please email hello@sprucecatering.com to get your event taken care of.
There's a real need in our society for bridging the gap. We have a show that does just that, called Just That, Bridging the Gap, here on CKUW 95.9 FM. On Thursdays at 10:30 a.m., you can listen to clinical and registered psychologist Dr. Cyrus Dirksen sharing some pretty meaty info to help you build that bridge.
Take a moment and just be in your own experience and kind of let go of the things in the future, let go of the things in the past, and try to watch what's happening to you right now. You can actually take a moment and just think about what it feels like to be you right now in whatever place you're sitting or standing. And it can be very healing to do that.
Bridging the Gap, Thursdays, 10:30 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM.
The Wrench is the Winnipeg Repair, Education, and Cycling Hub. Since 2010, The Wrench has used discarded bike parts collected from Winnipeg's 4R sites to educate our community in bike mechanics and to keep us all on our bikes through access to bikes and bike repair. Got a bike or some parts that you want to put to good use? Drop them off at any of the City of Winnipeg's 4R sites on Panet, Pacific, or Brady Road during their open hours. Wrench volunteers pick up from each location at least monthly and get those bikes back on the road through education programs, community bike repair supports, and bike giveaways. To learn more or become a volunteer, visit us at thewrench.ca.
Laying Looking out the window, there's a man there on the street. He's pushing a shopping cart. He's looking for cans and a brand new start. Four lines that separate the inside of these walls from that outside gate. Tell me what's the difference between him and me. Oh, tell me what's the difference and who does he see. Trying to get to heaven.